slides if you wish to reference that. In terms of the review, so last meeting, you'll recall, we met downstairs and introduced the capability service model, which is something they're exploring in the capital planning subcommittee. We reviewed co-location and joint use, and then provided examples of regional practice, as well as discussed some key themes and takeaways that we had seen from documents such as that they're using in Loudoun, Fairfax, Arlington, even Mecklenburg, Charlotte. We also reviewed the current practices and policies here in Alexandria for the city, as well as ACPS. And then subcommittee members went through a discussion talking about future considerations for the city and for the schools to explore further, including policies and frameworks, which we'll dive further into for the memo. And lastly, we ended it with an exercise where subcommittee members indicated which projects should be further explored for co-location opportunities and which services should be explored for further co-location opportunities. And we'll be summarizing that for the ultimate review. Any questions in terms of meeting three? Great. I believe AEDP is before we go, so.
Okay, well, before we start with AEP, I'll be the first to admit that I didn't realize how quickly this process was going. It forced us to have to make some priority decisions that I'm not quite sure all of us were prepared to make so quickly, and being forced into, I hate to use the term force, but being pushing our limits on what we needed to identify within the framework of the charge before, I think, at least this subcommittee felt that we had completely explored all of the opportunities associated with alternative delivery methods. What it brought to me was a realization that most of what we're exploring will probably end up being in the form of recommendations that will have to continue to be explored, because there's a requirement that the priorities that are already in the CIP for the school system in the city have to be sort of formalized, and this committee says, you know, this is what we think the priorities are. But I think the alternative delivery methods are a significant part of our requirement to help council and the board make better decisions going forward after year one. With that, we've asked AEP to come back and expound on some projects in the city that in terms of the status, you know, where they are, their recommendations. We've looked at the list that they, was talked about sort of generally before, and our role and our what we've asked Stephanie to do today is just sort of give us a framework for like what is each outstanding economic development project out there. You know, what is it? What is its scope? Where is it in terms of interaction, exchange, and consideration by the city, and then going down the list. That's where we're going to start today, I believe.
Yes. Okay. Great. Well, thanks for having us back. So the two things that I sort of walked away from our last meeting with was what Danielle has just said, kind of going through where some opportunities might exist in different types of real estate throughout the city. And then the second that I wanted to mention, and Catherine has this and can share with you, is we did go and look for examples of how other IBAs and EBAs have been involved in public-private partnerships throughout Virginia. And I don't have enough copies for everybody, but Catherine has this electronically. McGuire Woods Consulting is sort of tends to be the lead partner in Virginia, and so they have this entire chart here. And basically all of these projects were allowed / enabled through the PPEA Act of 2002 in Virginia. And when you flip through them, I mean, there's everything from elementary schools to broadband to art centers to, you know, everything. And so in the memo that we shared with you, we've called on a couple of examples that we think might be good comparables for us to take a look at if as you said, your recommendations turn into further study in the future. So that's sort of the background. Okay. We grouped the properties that you talked about into three kind of categories. One is existing sort of facilities or land where privatization or transfer or some sort of partnership might be beneficial. The second is this idea of creating new public assets like parking garages, using public-private partnerships to do that. And then the third was this idea of intervening or accelerating privately owned projects that are a city priority, but of which we have no, you know, stake in at this point other than just interest. So if it's okay with you, I'll just kind of go through and you can ask questions. And I guess I should say from the beginning, I realized that many of these projects are very sensitive. I've been around long enough to know that when you start poking at any of these, people get very concerned. And so again, today is just to share with you all information, talk about opportunity, and I think a focus on whether these should be looked at in a more detailed setting. So number one is the Torpedo Factory. Sort of the background there is that the building itself is managed by a combination now of Parks and Rec and General Services. Up until about a little over a year ago, it was actually leased to, it was run by a board that was set up by the city. And that had been going on for about 5 years. Prior to that, it had been leased to an arts organization who ran the building. And what we've seen over the last 5 to 7 years is that we have a facility that has a mandate to be an art center. There's a significant amount of deferred maintenance that as you go through CIP processes each year, frankly, does not jump up above schools and safety and other things. It's a, you know, it's arts and recreation. And there's also been this challenge in sort of managing who is a tenant in that building. And that's what the city's effort was to set up this board 5 or 7 years ago. Tried to accomplish. Frankly, it did not accomplish. I think everyone who was involved in it would tell you that. No fault of any particular entity or person, but that model didn't work. And so the manager was in a position as of last July to basically take control back of the building. And so where Jeremy's team, I think, has always sort of been involved in the maintenance of the physical building, now Parks and Rec Department is involved in the actual like management slash tenanting of the building. So that is a new advancement as of last July. I pulled this language about the deferred maintenance. I'm guessing it's probably continues to get larger, although I do think some projects have been accomplished. But there's a significant amount of capital that, again, just has not been prioritized. And so in the auspices of this conversation, one of the potential scenarios that you could look at is potentially bringing in a private partner, structuring a deal to bring in a private partner who would bring that capital up front to do this deferred maintenance and somehow create a shared revenue scenario. And in order to do that and meet the city's kind of stated goals, you have to make sure that the contract was for the execution of an art center or if there's some evolution of what that building should be. That's very detailed in the agreement, but then you bring this private partner in to kind of solve our capital issue.
The use of the Torpedo Factory as an art center is a statute?
I think it's probably a policy of some sort. I think we'd have to go back and look. It was, it's just always been that way.
I know that.
Right.
So I was wondering, is it legislated in some way, shape, or form? Or do we know?
I don't believe so. From the late 70s and early 80s, I mean, it was really led by artists to renovate and utilize the building. So the initial asset was sort of artist-led, mm-hmm. sort of a really maker space, using today's terms, and evolved from that point.
So, do we own it outright, or is there a bond that we understand that bond financing or anything on at this point? So, from the
there was some original transition of ownership, and I don't recall the exact model from. There's a couple transfers in the 80s and I think early 90s.
Right. Yeah.
But I can't remember the exact model.
From an operational standpoint, the rents that are collected, do they pay all of the bills, or is it a money winner or money loser for the city?
It is operating net neutral goal. It's fairly closely. Does not cover capital.
So there's nothing being put aside in it.
There's no capital reserve built into those numbers. It is utilities, real estate tax equivalent, essentially, and covers basic maintenance of the facility. They pay cleaning costs above that. pull up the city's base rent, then they pay additional rent above that for the programming, advertising, and support services to help market the asset.
And I know it's an attraction, obviously, but where did the artists come from? You know, the Altoona residents, is there any preference given?
I don't know the current breakdown. Some are from regional areas.
I'm in real estate, so that's, in my opinion, the single most valuable piece of property that the city owns. And I personally think there's an opportunity cost there, particularly in the year we're big on funding other very critical things. So have we ever put out any kind of an RFP to the general, I'll just call it the development community, or give us your ideas, your best thoughts on how to do this?
So
if we were to redo it.
Right. So I think for context, last July, when the city manager, I guess really it was the spring, when he proposed work, basically said we're going to take back control, there was a lot of angst about the future of the center, and there were a ton of people who were tenants and who had been involved in the actual original renovation and you know, in ceding to the city. And so when the city manager made this sort of decree that we were going to take back over, it was intended, one, to kind of calm the waters and say, like, we are committed to having this be an art center, because there were a ton of rumors kind of running around that a developer was going to come in and turn it into apartments, or and this, I think it was a 3-year period for leases, or was it 2 years? Do you remember?
Sure, we've been through a couple 5 years of 2 and/or 3.
It was 2 or 3 years essentially that he put out there, and he said that during this time frame, as a city, we will determine what the best model is for running this facility. And I frankly am not sure where we are in that process. I think a lot of other things have kind of come to head, and it's probably just been sort of simmering a little bit. But there was a communication that said this is not the final state, this is an interim state to sort of calm things. And I think that that if there is a desire to kind of look at these alternative models, it would be important for you all to weigh in. I don't think it's a decision you need to make. It would be a recommendation to further study.
I'm quite sure that
correct. But the facility is in a state of, it's in this in-between state right now.
Yeah, the question has been debated amongst prior boards, at least the Interpretive Factor Art Center Board, which is the initial quasi, well, at least there's folks who are not artists that were on that board. And it was debated amongst the board in terms of, is there a hybrid or other things, but those efforts did not pass the board. They were sort of debated and discussed at the board levels, but did not proceed in the board.
And last question, because I know you have a lot. I understand we've never officially asked for RFPs or possible reconfiguration, but sometimes it's a good measure of interest. Have we ever had any unsolicited offers?
We have had unsolicited offers sort of on the precipice of being submitted, and the feedback was that unless it is an offer to operate it as an art center, it would be inconsistent with current policy and they would not be considered.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up is Fitzgerald Square. So Fitzgerald Square is the future park that will be at the foot of King Street. This consists of two parcels that were owned by Old Dominion Boat Club, and the city negotiated a very difficult and challenging land swap / sale with them a few years ago. The boat club is about to move into their new facility that they have built just a couple of blocks down, and when I think it's 60 or 90 days after they take occupancy, this property officially becomes totally ours, although I think it's technically already ours. As we were planning for what should happen there, the city's waterfront plan calls for this beautiful park called Fitzgerald Square. There are hundreds of millions of dollars worth of improvements that are part of the waterfront plan, and so as things were prioritized, the ultimate state of Fitzgerald Square is sort of at the tail end of the waterfront implementation. But we all recognize that just having an empty boat club building sitting at the foot of King Street was not going to be good for us at all. So as a community, we decided on building an interim park. And so the interim park, which is going to cost about $1 million, is supposed to be realized next year. Demolition of the building will happen sometime in the first quarter probably of next year, and then this build out of the interim state will exist for, you know, questionable number of years. The ultimate pricing for Fitzgerald Square is $14 million. But one of the things, I think one of the reasons that this was probably on the list is because while we have budgeted to the build out of interim Fitzgerald Square, we don't necessarily have budgeting or resources or expertise to actually program it and make it active, which is something we're struggling with at a number of our public parks. And so the idea of who's going to program that park space, who would manage on park vendors, like an ice skating rink has been talked about, or a kayak launch, or somebody selling water. I think typically those things would probably fall to Parks and Rec or General Services, but they hadn't really been, there is no budget for them right now. And last year there was a discussion, or actually last year, this year there was a discussion about a business improvement district. One of the key roles of that business improvement district would have been to kind of play this role of activating public park spaces, as is done in many other places around this region. So this, again, is an example of a public asset that doesn't have, you know, might have the capital resources, but doesn't have sort of the operating resources to kind of operate at its highest and best use. And from a budgeting perspective, on the operating side, each year when we sit down and we kind of put our budgets together, things like this are oftentimes the first thing cut because they're sort of considered nice to haves. You know, money to program artists or activities or special events or, you know, festivals. Again, it's really difficult to compete against some of what we would consider our core services.
So that $14 million for the permanent park, is that anywhere in the CIP right now?
I haven't seen sitting out here in the waterfront. I'm not as familiar with the waterfront CIP is that any other sections?
I know it's at the end of the waterfront chart of CIP projects, but I don't know how the span of that chart.
Okay.
Okay, next up is Gadsby's Tavern. So you know, right behind us here, building and land that's owned by the city. Again, it's managed by a combination of departments. From a day-to-day operations, it's the Office of Historic Alexandria. It operates as a museum and a restaurant. And then there's also the American Legion, which is in the back portion of the building along Cameron Street. The city has traditionally executed a lease with a restaurant operator to do the restaurant work. And earlier this year, they put out an RFI looking for some new operators or to compete the existing, and did not get very good responses. Again, I don't know if it's a policy or if it's just a practice, but the RFI was focused on operating a federal era themed restaurant, so it was pretty limited. It's part of the historic, you know, sort of seen as part of our historic museum and activities where we're trying to get people to experience what it was like to be here a long time ago. And I think there are very few people who focus on that sort of restaurant experience. So that's the story there.
Does Gatsby's Tavern, from an operating standpoint, break even, make money, lose money?
No.
I think they do. I mean, I don't think they make money. There's not a lot of upside to it, just based upon what I've visited and talked to them. But there's the limitations of what they can do there makes it prohibitive to really make much money. So by having to serve the store food, any chef that goes in there really doesn't have the means to do something with that. So there's a challenge there.
And this is what you got, what, $6.5 million? See, I think that's something down the road.
The backstory on the American Legion, I didn't know this before I kind of looked into it, was that the American Legion actually saved those buildings from demolition during
individual members mortgage their own homes and other things that the choir renovated structure. And then the transfer agreement to the city was that we would maintain American Legion, post in perpetuity for them and do the upkeep as part of the transfer.
So that's,
I think it was 1929.
So, yeah, 1929. So if you look at the building, there's sort of three sections of it. The American Legion is the back portion, and the restaurant and museum are these pieces here. Yes.
Yeah, part of the $6 million, not only the base foundation renovation, but the idea would be to figure out how to include the upper banquet hall for an accessibility standpoint, because you really can't rent it out, it's not accessible. So it would be, you know, adding an attachment to the back courtyard where you have an elevator to bring it up to compliance and the more rentable, have some more appeal. There's also some bathroom limitation issues that, you know, limit its appeal to people looking to rent out the place. They experience that quite a bit.
The kitchen, it's located in the basement, very low ceiling heights, and it's very limited as far as what you could do there. And they've actually had to expand upstairs and take away part of the dining room in order to accommodate a lot of people coming in and food. So there's a lot of limitations there.
So unlike Torpedo Factory, which sounds like it might have a policy that would be changed, it sounds like the only way this in perpetuity, the only way to you can get it back, I guess, but it doesn't sound like you can change.
There's in perpetuity implies the adjacent structure of the Legion Hall, right?
Correct.
Yeah,
so
not the
but is part of this trade that occurred with the American Legion. Use restrictions put on Gatsby's in perpetuity?
Loosely, the transfer agreement, you know, has sort of the enjoyment, but sort of the character of Gatsby's sort of statements within it. My recollection, it does not have fairly sort of scaffold out precision to that language.
So it doesn't necessarily say federalist food.
It does not have those words.
That's
something that is an Office of Historic Alexandria program requirement, but not necessarily a deed or a transfer requirement.
Has the city ever applied historical preservation deal? And you know, locally, Dave Rubin signs a huge supporter. Have we ever applied for a grant to do the things that are included in the 6 or 6.5 million?
Not for this project. I don't know about prior projects. I'm sure there have been over time. We have a lot of different ones that come into play over here.
Probably the Office of Historic Alexandria. They're the ones who applied for grants that allowed for the acquisition of the Reeder House on South St. Asaph. So I think they would lead that charge. So the last few in this category, I didn't spend too much time writing details about, because I think you probably have looked at them. City Hall, obviously we sit on, are sitting in a building land at a parking garage owned by the City of Alexandria. If the Torpedo, talking about changing the use of the Torpedo Factory is controversial, I would say that talking about the change of use of City Hall is off the charts. But there have been some, you know, sort of discussions, ideas thrown out about what the original use of the first floor of City Hall was. It was open air markets. We have, you know, obviously a really great farmers market that operates here on the weekends. And so if there was some sort of desire to change the mandate of how this property was used, is there an opportunity to kind of go back to the historically accurate use of the first floor here and have it be more of an anchor / attraction more than just Saturdays? You could still keep the second floor operating as a seat of government, do other things. Obviously, there's a renovation happening in real time here.
That's just
recording. Yeah, correct, right? That's Jeremy's phone. Yeah, exactly. But if there was a desire to look at some sort of public-private partnership for this building, those are the sorts of uses that would likely be of interest. Again, bringing back this idea of the first floor being used as a cafe, year-round farmer's market, you know, stalls, things like that.
But again, never formal RFP that was issued for RFI issue or unsolicited.
No. And one of the projects that I guess maybe I would flag for you as potentially a comparable is, I think it's Manassas Park. They sent out an RFI to basically do a swap. So they had a city hall that there was some interest in to use as an office building. And so they put out an RFI, and their partner ended up actually finding an alternative site for city hall and then turning it into, and I don't know what the, didn't spend enough time looking at it. There was probably, I'm sure it had to do with location and, so there are different ways that you could potentially achieve that. The shooting range and the impound lot, I would just sort of group together as properties that are out near the Vanbrugh Metro Station. During discussions in the Eisenhower West Small Area Plan and just in general, there's always been this idea that just because we own property somewhere doesn't necessarily mean that the uses should stay there if they're not the highest and best uses. But these two projects, I think the shooting range in particular, are pretty expensive to relocate, and there are tons of reasons that we continue to keep them there. But both of these, I think, are things that as Eisenhower West continues to move forward with development, or just move forward, there's not a whole lot happening just yet. You know, does it make sense for the city to hold these assets kind of in between a node of office buildings and a metro station? And I think if you all, I don't know if you've talked about the shooting range, but I know Jeremy could. Exactly. So I won't get into that. Again, these are all just the most controversial ideas here. George Washington Middle School, the athletic fields literally sit next to the Braddock Road Metro Station. And so when you look at the long-term highest and best use, clearly we're at a shortage of green space and recreation space for our students. But you also could envision a scenario where you could actually have a building and put some of that space on rooftops or kind of employ a more urban school model. When you look at an aerial of metro stations throughout the DC region, it is very rare to find a kind of a passive use like that next to the metro. It doesn't help with ridership, it doesn't help with you know, with this idea of clustering density around these very expensive metro stations. So it is something that has come up before. And so we
well, again,
put it
in
on
contrast
list
to some of the other political jurisdictions, like Arlington, for example, which didn't have a height limitation around its butt hat, but it was very high. They did a Christmas tree development, so the highest building to right on top of the metro.
Right.
So we chose not to do that when we originally started to build around metro. And, you know, I think some, you know, said, well, you know, maybe you missed an opportunity. So, I mean, I think your point is especially well taken with, because I do think in urban environments more and more, you are having rooftop fields.
Sure. Absolutely. And then the final one, sort of on this category, is a bit of a moving target, or you know, might come to resolution prior to your recommendations. But the Cameron Run Regional Park, there is an existing ground lease that is expiring with the Regional Park Authority, and our Park and Rec Commission issued a memo relatively recently that had some strong recommendations about opening up the opportunity to consider alternative uses to meet our recreational demands. And I believe that the city manager is supposed to be weighing in on this very shortly.
How big is that acreage?
I think it's but it has some RPA, there's an adjacent Lake Cook, there are some restrictions. It also is, you know, there are tons of other recreational uses that people would like to see there. So kind of opening it up beyond recreation is probably not going to happen, although there has been some discussion about using it as a school site. But this existing ground lease was sort of the limiter. And so making a decision about, to proceed or not proceed with them is probably step one. And then step two would be a study / some sort of process to figure out what uses we should consider as alternatives.
Assume that these expire.
Yeah, it's, I think it's like 3 years or 4 years from now, but there was a decision, the lessee wanted to make a capital improvement on site, and that's what was pushing the conversation. Am I right? Is that?
That's right. They wanted an extension, that way they could amortize the investment on the site, and that's been the sort of pending decision. So I think they were, at the time, within a 5 year at the end of term, and so I think they're about 3 years left. I'm looking over to Beth, but I think it's close to the parameters.
So what were they building? What's the capital investment that they wanted to take?
It was a new slide.
Yeah.
A fancy new slide at the water park.
Had a swirly.
Correct. But the larger discussion about the site that the Park and Rec Commission has really weighed in on is this existing ground lease is for an operation that is seasonal. And so we have this asset that we don't have use of for multiple months, and we've got a higher fee. So and then also it is because of who the lessee is, it is there is no monetary value for the lease for us right now, because it is a lease with an organization that we actually pay into. And so the idea that we're not actually recovering any cost by leasing it to somebody, and we don't have access to the site or use of it for the majority of the year. Okay, so creation of new public assets. This was sort of the idea of using some sort of public-private partnership to build something like parking garages. The good news is that there are tons of examples, just very, very close to us here in the state, of jurisdictions who have used this model to add parking to their downtowns. There is a project that's been pending in the town of Vienna, where essentially a private developer is going to develop a corner and will build an additional amount of parking to provide some public parking garage with an agreement from the city to purchase it or take ownership of it afterwards. So there are a variety of different models this could take, and I think that this is probably the easiest public-private partnership to kind of wade into, because it's very clearly using either public financing or public dollars to provide a public benefit.
Well, I think Franklin Halston has spoken to this one. I know.
Yep.
The 3700 spot.
That's right.
Garage, which I believe the city or the county owns, but it
yep.
started a lot of development there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, and it also comes with some revenue source, right? So there's something you build in, you don't need to pay off the debt. I think this was put on the list as an idea of when you're looking potentially here in Old Town, especially at some small parcels that we own. There is an active response to an RFP out for some sites here in Old Town that we can't really talk about, but there are still other sites within Old Town and probably other parts of the city where this might be an important tool to think about. And so then the final category of properties that we asked us to talk about are intervening. We're trying to find a positive way to talk about projects as an alternative to using the term stalled. These are pieces of property, privately owned pieces of property that are either key pieces of a community or a neighborhood that we have adopted a small area plan for and we are hoping to see move along. And or are just big pieces of property that that bring a lot of potential. So Robinson North, the east parcel, this is the north side of the waterfront plan. Basically all of the parcels that have the potential to develop that we approved in the waterfront plan have moved forward, except for Robinson Terminal North. And it is split into two sides. And the two sides are actually for sale. And the west side is under contract for residential development, but the east side, the city really would like to see and has approved in our plan commercial activity, specifically a hotel, restaurants. There's a 1 acre pier that is envisioned to be very similar to probably things that we now see over at the wharf and in the Capitol Riverfront, active public space with very amazing events and activities. The problem right now is that the pricing and the cost of the public benefits that were negotiated essentially don't make it market, don't make the numbers work. And so while it's on the market, there really aren't any purchasers.
For the east side,
for the existing set of uses. And there are a couple of examples that we thought could be good comparables in Harrisonburg. The university and the city of Harrisonburg really wanted to see a hotel and conference center, but the market was not, nobody was stepping forward. So they entered into a public-private partnership where they were able to contribute land or a portion of the financing to help facilitate that hotel and conference center's opening at the end of this year. And then the second is a project that's right in the middle of being negotiated. It's the Virginia Beach Arena. And again, there was this desire to build this complex that would be commercial and would generate a significant amount of revenue. The tool that they're using there is this idea of creating like a TIF, a tax increment financing district, where the revenue that will be made off of ticket sales will then be dedicated to paying off portions of the debt affiliated with the project. So something, not 100% comparable, but I think it's something to think about. If this is a project that we feel is really important, we want to intervene, are there some financing tools we can bring to the table? The Genon Power Plant is a decommissioned coal fire plant at the north end of Old Town. It is desired to be an anchor of some sort for that community, potentially with an arts focus. The land is owned by Pepco. It is certainly not going to continue to be used as its current use, but what it can be or what it should be is kind of up in the air. Right now, we're in a situation where we just are kind of waiting for Pepco to finish the decommissioning process, and we wait for them to approach us. And so again, if the idea is to somehow structure public-private partnerships to accelerate development or kind of push the private sector, I think that this could be an interesting site for us to think about.
Yeah, there would be environmental issues there.
We don't fully know yet. There's only been a phase one, but from everything we've heard, it's not any different or any worse than some of the other properties along the waterfront. It's been a singular use for multiple decades, unlike multiple other properties who have had really bad uses, tons of them. But until there's a complete phase two, we're not sure.
I will say this, that any potential purchase for that will look at the entire waterfront, and they'll look for the creativity and the flexibility of the city in having done whatever we've done in terms of what they offer Pepco and what they plan to do.
That's right.
So, I mean, this Robinson Northeast parcel is really important for that reason,
Sure.
As well as, frankly, accelerating other redevelopment, because that's a total, is it 35 acres? But some of it's going to be Dominion.
It's 25 acres, and really the only useful portion of it is 15 acres.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's obviously
the water.
That's right. That will attract international attention.
Yes. I think the other things that we should mention on these two parcels is marinas. Something that is extremely expensive, and the city has priced out for. We have a public marina already, and as part of the waterfront plan, there's movements. And again, it's probably one of those things that's never going to come up to the top of our list. And so, if there is some way to use public-private partnerships to encourage private sector to invest in marina activity at some of these other private sites, that might be of interest. There's some demand. What that is depends on who you talk to. The people who are currently leasing slips at the marina will tell you there's strong demand. But I think we have enough data in DC marinas and over at National Harbor that we could actually probably get some good comparables. But those are uses I think that could fit potentially at either one of those sites. On the opposite end of the city, Landmark Mall is a closed regional mall. It is mostly controlled by a large mixed-use developer. They own 2/3 of the site. The last third, they are in the final stages of negotiating a joint venture with, and they will be re-engaging with the city at the beginning of next year to basically replan that 52 acres of opportunity. The approved plan was for a town center that was going to be built in phases, and now that they will have gained or achieved maximum control of the site, and frankly, decades have passed, it's time to replan. and make sure that they're not building the last town center as it goes out of style, and instead are building the first whatever. So, which is probably smart, right? So maybe that's the silver lining. But the city has previously had discussions with them about using a TIF model to help fund a portion of that project. And so I think that as they come back to the city and have discussions, this might be a property where it makes sense for us to explore public-private partnership to potentially include some city uses or some community benefits that we'd like to see on the site.
I know Fairfax County used the TIF model for a vehicle lot for the very first time. I was at to do that public project, which I think has helped that project be successful.
Definitely.
But how soon, honestly, do you think there's going to be something happening on it? I mean, we've got a 10-year capital improvement plan.
Yeah, 2020 is when I think, so that's what we're saying. So 2018 and 2019, they will use to re-engage the community and city, replan, go through the entitlement process. They just signed a temporary agreement with the Carpenter Shelter to use it for the next 2 years as a temporary use. So 2020 is sort of the date that we're all talking about.
So, the next question, how many times in the past have you read your prognosis?
Probably, so I've been here 12 years, 12 divided by 3. There you go. The difference this time is that the site will be controlled by one entity for the first time. But I think your insinuation is fair.
I think the thing that's the same is still, the site is still in the city of Alexandria, and the process is just the process.
Mm-hmm.
And for a 50-acre site, I have trouble getting my pool building at my house. These large projects, everyone I talk to in the business takes forever. So this is 3 years worth of business. I think, I hope
yes.
I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I'd love to be wrong.
Well, and to be fair,
I can walk to that new movie theater.
That's right.
There's it.
And my 3 year is the first shovel. It's not completion of the project.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's the dollar value of that site?
I haven't looked that up in a while.
Well, its current use?
Yeah. Oh. The real estate value, I mean, that's one of the charts we've used to show, has dropped, it's been cut in half like four times over the last 12 years. And then obviously there's no revenue being generated on the site right now because the mall closed in January. And even then it was a very sad mall, so it wasn't.
It used to be a sizable contributor.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was my first job.
Yep.
So what does the city have to trade?
Well, so I think a couple things to think about. Certainly, I think when we replan, we will revisit the density that was approved and see if it makes sense to include more density. But I think the second is to think about, are there uses that we'd like to see on the West End? Are there recreation centers? Are there schools? Are there transit centers? Are there public facilities that we would potentially bring to the table that would help build out the mix, and we also then would bring some financing to the table.
Are there regular meetings? Are there regular meetings?
I would say somebody in our circle talks to them probably every other week. There is a Landmark Van Dorn implementation group that has been, hasn't been meeting too much, but I think they're meeting next week. That's tracking a number of development projects out that way. But this has been one of those projects where we don't have any skin in the game, so there's very little we've been able to do to influence the timelines.
And so I think, I sent you this list of all third rail, so I apologize for putting them.
That's okay.
You can blame me. These are my personal observations of projects where I think we needed more information, so thank you for treading in the dangerous waters. I appreciate that. You did that for me. You have to give to get, and that's bottom line, everything here. We haven't been willing to give on anything to get something in return. We haven't been willing to give on the Federalist food across the street. We haven't been willing to give on the artists and the most valuable real estate we own. Been willing to give on thinking about using this building a different way. We've been willing to give anything to get skin in the game to move these projects forward. So I think that I portion of the memo, if I have to write there, a second memo that is the Dwight Duncan opinion, that is what I want to convey to our leadership, is if we want to get things, we have to give up on things, and we have to really rank order what's important. Just because we did something, you said it, that a historical use in the past does not mean that's what we should be using it in the future, if we want to have a viable future. And so I will do everything I can to help clear the way so that you guys can bring all the tools to bear that AEDP may have at its disposal. I think you guys have done an admirable job being completely handcuffed, in my opinion, watching from the outside in, of saying we'd like you to create economic development, but we're really not going to do anything to help you to do that. We're not going to give you access to tips, tools. We're not going to say, you know what, the historical use is no longer a requirement. It's an option, but let's see what is available. And so I appreciate everything you've done, and I would like to find a way to unshackle you guys so that we can really bring more prosperity, reduce some of the capital commitments that we have based on these historical uses, more importantly, create more cash flow and more revenues to the city so that we can do all these things that we desperately need, but we don't have the funding for it.
Well, thanks. I mean, and maybe this is like the great way to kind of end it. I think as you're thinking about your recommendations, we do have AEDP and our IDA are structured differently than the internal government. And there are some powers and some flexibility that those two organizations have and could play a role in some of these public-private partnerships. We're not necessarily positioned or staffed to do that right now, but if part of your recommendation is to look at those more carefully, we are a willing partner. And we have board members who very much are interested in taking kind of economic development from the traditional find office tenants, find retail tenants to this next kind of phase, which is helping to create some of these anchors and new commercial assets that are going to help with our overall tax revenue issues.
And I, full disclosure, I'm on the board, but I 100% agree with what was just said. Victory Center, what is the timing of this that you got last chance?
Right. Following Dwight's question about Landmark, I feel like I've said this 5 gazillion times about Victory Center. This procurement is scheduled to be closed by the end of this calendar year, is what we're being told. It's for the Drug Enforcement Agency. And it is I do believe this is the last hope for this building as an office building.
And they're currently in
Pentagon City.
On Metro.
On Metro. I think we wrote here the opportunity for us is that if this procurement fails, then the ownership structure of that building, I believe, is going to consider changing. They're going to say, we own and operate federally leased buildings. We have been trying to lease this building to a federal entity for 12 years. Clearly it's not working. Let's extract it from our fund and let's get rid of it. And so if we have any interest in this site, now would be the time for us to be thinking about if and how we would want to participate and or I don't know if we'd ever want to buy that building. That would be a very, very large building for anyone to own. But if we want to intervene or influence the sale, now would be the time for us to kind of think about it.
What's, I'm sorry, what's the size of that
space? It's 600,000 square feet. Office building. It's probably 13 acres, I think, if I'm remembering correctly.
But it could add another 400,000.
It can almost double. I think it's 1.2.
Does the city have any large procurements that would fall on the lease side that could fall within the time frame, assuming this DEA thing doesn't happen?
We are working on some lease consolidations, but it's roughly a third of that site.
And
so
I think
roughly around 200,000 square feet. We have need of.
Again, I understand Prudential got in there to the TSA fund,
right.
But if that changes, we've got other funds.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I would be very happy to have a third of that building leased after 12 years.
That's true.
The issue with the site is for the clients we're looking for, it doesn't necessarily meet the client map. As more precisely, you know, we're looking at the consolidation of leases between ECHS or Human Services Division, as well as the assessment of whether to include Health Department. And so those sort of clusters, and smaller cluster in Alandria, and then a very large one in the Beauregard corridor, which also aligns with where there's opportunity right now. So that would be slightly off where the sort of density of clients are, but it's still not enough.
I know we represent the landlord in Arlington when they consolidated. They actually moved off Metro in Clarendon to the Sequoia Plaza project. The great thing about Arlington County was
all the buildings and campuses there is nice.
Okay, and public schools is there, and Human Services, yep. And they do have an option to buy.
We're also looking at a similar kind of acquisition option within our discussions.
Is there any thought to demolition that building?
So the reason probably that option has not risen is that 12 years ago, they actually invested a pretty ridiculous amount of money in hardening the facade of that building to prepare it for a federal entity. So, but I mean, at some point, if no one wants to lease it, and if it's structurally not compliant, it has very low ceilings, you know, I've been talking about this at the last meeting, I mean, she's looked at it before. You can't change ceiling heights. Oh, well, I mean, I guess you can, but
yeah. Take out.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. Right, every other one. Yeah. So we'll see.
If it hadn't been prudential that the owner, it would have long ago gone into a reversion of foreclosure.
Right.
Could have gotten it cheap.
That's right.
Well, I mean, I think that the fact that the task force has looked at this as an opportunity that hasn't happened before in a comprehensive manner. And so, you know, one of, I think, our responsibilities would be to help provide the decision makers with the what is it that they get. I mean, because I see that as really what's missing. All decision makers need to know this is what we're going to get on a comprehensive manner, not on a project-by-project basis. And although I know that's been part of your role, it's been part of various groups' roles, maybe that's one of the things we can do to ask the hard questions and our recommendations that will lead them to decision points for multiple projects. Because sometimes that's really what's missing. It's not that the committees or the boards and all, it's languishing because someone, or they haven't zeroed in on what is the get and how does that relate to all the other projects within part of the region, all the city, whatever it is. So.
Well, to that point, and I think that's a really excellent point, maybe this gives you guys an excuse to gin up a meeting with another one with Howard Hughes, share the capital improvement program for the next 10 years. You know what? If we've got a couple of pools that we're trying to renovate, build, wouldn't be a bad location, I don't think, as part of 52 acres.
Right.
So maybe get them invested and excited about some of this stuff. And, you know, maybe at some point that would have been discussed anyway when, you know, the public benefit is discussed. Mm-hmm. But they know we've got this high priority of 10-year activities.
Yeah.
I
say, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that we need to communicate is we all love Alexandria. Alexandria does not live in a bubble. And take Howard Hughes. They have redevelopment projects all over the country. They're going to spend their time and capital in the areas where they get the highest return. And in those other jurisdictions, they may have availed themselves of tools that we historically have chosen not to use because we're Alexandria and this is how we do it. And we could put ourselves at a competitive disadvantage to get their attention and their capital. Cut, copy, paste Howard Hughes with all these other opportunities. So we are a competitive world for capital and attention. My company, my family has been doing business in the city of Alexandria for 7 years. We only own one project, but we own $500 million worth of real estate in other parts of the state because time and attention gets a much higher return other places. And that is the bottom line, I think, to what we want to help with AEDP and any other tool is get the leadership to recognize that we love Alexandria, that we are in a competitive world, and if we don't become competitive in the tools we use to attract capital and attention, we are never going to get our priorities accomplished, ever. And the city that we love will fall down relative to our neighbors who are deploying these new and novel approaches to generating economic activity and vitality.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for letting us come 2 weeks later. Today is a momentous day for us. We are submitting our proposals for the Amazon headquarters. So we have been spending the last couple of weeks completely sleepless and immersed. We have one more set of edits to do, but thank you for letting us take a 2 week pass.
So, if
and
it's
they
a
they do, well, I shouldn't not say that.
Is it okay? Obviously, we've asked some questions that relate to this, and you kind of jump-started us. Is it possible, and again, after you submit your Amazon?
Yes, yes.
But could we ask AEP to expand the memo a little bit and address some of the answers that they provided to questions, and then resend it to us?
Oh, that would be good. Okay.
Yeah, again, I know you got the Amazon, but
yeah.
When you have a chance.
Sure.
I think that's what you're saying today's discussion.
I'm just saying it would be helpful to have, if we consider this a draft, and then we
and
had
just
a memo.
Do the questions
as part of the memo.
Yes.
Yes.
So if you guys could send your notes. I just want to make sure I understand the questions you are talking about.
The questions that we asked during the discussion,
we
would like to add them to have to resubmit the memo for the answers to those questions.
Okay.
And so I can see questions.
Come into questions. Because I know when you're rolling. Yeah. That would be good. Oh, good. Thank you. All right.
Well, we've got about 15 minutes till the next crew. 10-15 minutes before the next crew shows up. We wanted to touch base a little bit on what we talked about last time. I'll hand it over to Cassie.
Yeah, so last time we talked about co-location. We showed you this chart and we explained that as part of project strategy and understanding these sort of capability needs and demand management, you really have to understand the who and the where. So in co-location, we discussed the where. And again, just bringing this up to just for discussion, the service provider can definitely be a who when talking about alternatives. So I got this quote, government has to fit the rhythm of the life of the people. And really why this speaks to me is that I think as a government, your customers are your citizens, and it really needs to be flexible in providing services so that those citizens can feel like they have a one-stop shop, something that's very integrated, very easy to understand. So these are some different concepts that exist and are fairly successful when delivering services through alternative methods. So for example, shared services, P3 for service delivery, outsourcing, and the use of non-governmental organization partnerships. And so I'll just go through these very high level. I think they're pretty intuitive. So for example, with shared services, this is when a citizen interface might just have like a one-stop shop. This works really well for municipal administrative services, but behind that, you might have multiple departments. So this really gets into the conversation of providing a more streamlined, efficient process for things like repeated activities, bringing some centralized thought to the discussion. So again, this works well with shared technology platforms. Think of like a website where multiple departments might have their piece, but a citizen or a customer may only see one space where they're able to really get information, do municipal activity. So then to roll right through, P3s are great for alternative methods for service deliveries. So we see this quite often in public transportation, for example, healthcare, rec and fitness, even alcohol sales. Montgomery County is a great example of this. So this idea is that you leverage the experience of the private sector to deliver services that will have a public benefit, but this is thinking of it outside of just the actual physical facility space consideration. So this is where a city and the P3 service provider has that same agreement, exactly like you would use for any sort of facility or co-location discussion we've been having before, but instead this is entirely for services. Again, the P3 providing the services directly to the citizens, and sometimes the city doing as well. So this is probably one of the most pure examples of an alternative delivery method for service providers, and one that many people are familiar with. So it's this notion of transferring business functions and services to a third party completely. So again, IT, this is really popular with IT, data processing, facility maintenance, skills training. It's this notion that it's best to use a third party who specializes in this sort of service, and perhaps creating cost efficiencies and resource efficiencies for the city. So this also frees up things like administrative time as well as dollars often. And then finally, because I promised you I'd go through this really quickly, non-governmental organizations. So the beauty of non-governmental organizations, and I think we saw this today with AEDP, is that they're flexible. They're on the ground with citizens and businesses, and they tend to understand the comprehensive challenges and opportunities for service. So Alexandria actually uses this already quite a bit for nonprofit housing developers who do things like affordable housing and senior housing. Also, any sort of business technical assistance providers, job readiness, counseling, preschools. The reason why I put this up here is because I think this list can actually be expanded quite a bit. So it's this notion of, actually Washington DC does this often too. It's the idea of coming, farming out services that the government currently owns and provides, and allowing nonprofits or NGOs to take on those services.
So I'm just going to add that as we consider these and look at them, as much as I believe in all of these alternatives, mm-hmm. but unfortunately, there's always this issue of accountability for public mm-hmm. service, culture, and responsibilities that the nonprofits or the public entity, the private entities don't always bring to the table. Mm-hmm. So we have to be considerate of that as we start to look at, as in any organization starts to implement, you know, those types of things. I think that they are all worthwhile. The structure of the public organization mm-hmm. has to set up firewalls and has to have established public service values incorporated in the delivery of service to the public. And that's where I think a lot of these have challenges when they're actually implemented, whether regardless of what the entity is. That's always the tug and pull.
You're exactly right. And honestly, for any alternative to work, you have to have very clear written agreements, memorandums of understanding, but then also you have to have operating agreements with these sort of key performance indicators and pulls, so that both parties, for example, in the P3 space, when you have, let's say, a developer own, operate, maintain a space, but it's being ground leased, you're generally going to have some sort of operating agreement with very, very specific standards and key performance indicators. So that should any of those performance indicators be triggered, for example, maintenance, customer satisfaction, overall deferred maintenance, reserve funds, those sorts of things. Should any of those things be triggered, the deal opens up. And the owner, or in this case, the person who holds the ground lease, can essentially use that power to make sure that something happens. Now, are there flaws? Absolutely. But coming from a DC background, where I was actually a grant manager, for housing counseling services, small business technical assistance, and actually facade programs, because they effectively farm out all of their community development. It made projects go so much more, projects were very nimble. And as a grant manager, my position was essentially to keep the organizations honest, to monitor those key performance indicators, but instead of, you know, performing for 20 different services, I was able to oversee 10 different grants, right? And reach the city in delivering services that the city had promised. And, you know, should year to year a grantee fail to do what they had agreed to, they weren't a grantee the following year.
So, Mignogna, you hit the nail on the head. I think that we have to have accountability. I think that when we outsource, though, we tend to, as people, tend to put an unnecessary bias against outsourcing, because we feel like if whoever's providing the services, our employee, we have more control. We have more accountability. And that is not, in my experience, always the case. In my own company, it's easier to fire a contractor than it is an employee. And I certainly see that in government, that holding someone accountable for failing to meet KPIs is more challenging when that person receives a paycheck from the municipality than that person is a contract vendor for the municipality. And so I just want to stress that control is an illusion. You can't force anyone to do anything, no matter what your relationship is with them. And so let's not unnecessarily bias against these types of structures, because that person may not receive a paycheck directly from the municipality. It could turn out, in certain cases, to be give us way more control, because it's easier to manage a contract relationship that you can sever in a heartbeat versus having to work through the administrative process of getting a non-performer out of as an employee. And so I just wanted to say that let's not inadvertently bias ourselves because there's this perception that we don't have control because they're not our employees.
I'm really glad that you did make that comment, because I think that speaks to all of our requirements to start to move and help our lawmakers and help our society move to the next level of technology and management. I mean, it takes training. I work for a school system that doesn't do telework, because what school systems do telework on the administrator side? But you and I both know that just because you see somebody doesn't mean they're not working. Giving people the ability to understand what the framework and the expectation is, and for them to, you know, be productive, is a matter of teaching people how to work in that type of environment. And so what you're talking about is a matter of training and expectations that have to come along with change, and have to come along with how we, you know, change and model our organizations to be able to support these alternative methods. So I'm glad you picked up on that. I put you in. But I mean it, but it's true. It's both sides of it. And I loved your example. But so much of it is training the trainers and training our managers and helping people to move into a different, helping our city here to move into a different way of thinking in terms of our processes and the ways that we're working, because we've got to grow. This culture and the society is growing.
And so
our business practices have to take on a flexibility that has structure and accountability at the same time. It's able to provide growth and change.
Yes. And because I want to link this back to the conversations we've been having with Elliot's subcommittee on planning, mm-hmm. that it's not looking at a project for the sake of the project, and it's stepping back to understand what services are you providing, and then after you frame up that, then shaping the physical asset needs, for to provide this, the seats, the workspace, or the physical asset of what needs to support that. To step back and think through how these services are. We're at time, so maybe we leave it with some open questions.
I guess one last question. I'm not sure if the committee reviewed what delivery services we are providing within the city that do meet those. Mm-hmm. Some of what you talked about, mm-hmm. Was previously reviewed or distributed. I mean, just for example, to mind, for instance, animal control services are contract service. We provide the facility, we make in it, but they provide the day-to-day service. We track their KPIs in terms of euthanasia rate, adoption rates, all the rest of it. They do private fundraising to augment services, behavioral, dog placement, the full gamut of services that we sort of partner with them. Neighborhood health services comes to mind, partnership with the health department. There's sort of lots of different layers, mm-hmm. depending on those organizations that can be nimble to respond to things a little bit more quickly. They've done a good job for us in the past. So there are I think plenty of different examples across the organization you might not think about, but we do provide
ground leases for our firms.
Yep. Ground leases we have.
Are those compliant?
Yeah, they're compliant.
Not across, I don't have.
We'll make, how about, we'll compile a list.
Examples throughout different departments.
On both, on schools and city, yeah.
I think that's really important, that if we're going to stress that we need to change the way we approach businesses, to say this really isn't a change, we're just going to increase the proportion of things open to these things.
And I think the question is probably back to the side of the capability and demand management questions.
Yeah.
Of if you frame in the memo, as you're looking at either reinvestment or other major issues, ask this question first, which is, I think, a very good one in terms of how you deliver, how are you meeting it, should you meet it, what other all options are out there before you jump down the road and make a 20-year commitment to a model based on capital infrastructure and other options. I think that's a great way to, I think, frame this.
Yes, exactly. And I think I would leave everyone with, I know we kind of went through this quickly, but with thinking of providing, the thought process that goes into alternative service providers also begs the alternative funding and financing, because then you begin to be able to leverage. So for example, you provide the building, contract out the service, suddenly you're thinking of financing and operations in a very, very different way. And so again, this is more of just a thought-provoking discussion as part of our alternatives round.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
We're going to deal with logistics.